Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcast. My name is Dave Page, and I'm a paramedic instructor at Inver Hills Community College. I'm here with
Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation.
Dr. Keith Wesley, I'm medical director for Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul.
And Josh Salzman, director of critical care research at Regions Hospital in St. Paul.
So we're going to take a look at something a little bit different this time. It is out of Biomed Central. It's an Australian project. I'm assuming Dr. Ahrens, but Glenn Ahrens and company have published a study protocol. This was published on June 8, 2011, electronically, and the link will be available with this podcast. We found this study prospectus or protocol to be quite intriguing and worth some press, worth some airtime to discuss sort of their methodology. Frankly, we can't wait for the results. We're just really wanting the results of the project just as much as we're interested in the methods.
Did you give us the title of that study?
I am sorry, I probably did not. And the study is a Paramed Home. Paramed meaning PARAMED, home, a protocol for a randomized controlled trial of paramedic assessment and referral to access medical care at home. So this really bridges the worlds of both non-transport and maybe the concepts of community paramedic and treatment and non-transport, overcrowding of emergency departments, etc. So the study design here is quite interesting. In a randomized controlled way, patients would be identified as, if they were having a minor problem, that they would be identified as possibly being enrolled in the study and remaining at home, where the paramedic would simply do an assessment and then refer them to a traveling nurse practitioner who would visit them at home and care for them at home instead of them coming to the emergency department. So the idea being that there's an intentional desire to reduce the number of transports and an increased level of assessment on the part of the paramedics to triage who could receive home care by this nurse practitioner instead of going to the emergency department. So kudos to these folks for doing a randomized, controlled, prospective research project, which in EMS is very difficult to do and very rare. And
now we need to be clear. Yeah. They haven't done the study yet. This is just a proposed protocol.
That's right. That's
I'm
right.
I'm seeing
Sorry.
All kinds of IRB issues.
You
with
are.
Randomizing who I can send paramedics to and get care. What do you think,
Jeff? You know, our experience with this, because they do note in here that they will take the patient through an actual consent process. That it makes it more likely that from a review standpoint, it'll go through. But I do kind of, the population in which they're going to be doing or randomizing patients is low acuity. They shouldn't be people from what they've laid out here that would have any AMS or problem providing a true informed consent. But
altered mental status.
Right, sorry. Yep. Altered mental status. So the one thing along those lines I keep thinking about and the most interesting piece that I will want to see is how many patients, once they randomize them, will then withdraw their consent because they're going to be randomized to the arm where that they'll receive the home care portion of it.
Yeah,
because
there's
theoretically,
a potential for bias there.
Right, and so you're going to have a lot of crossover into patients who are randomized into one arm but actually go to the hospital. That's my assumption, so I think it will be really fascinating to find out how often that happens or if patients in an EMS system in Australia are more willing to take counsel and guidance from the paramedics on scene about what is reasonable for their care,
yeah,
and go forward with that. So that's a huge interest of mine just personally, but I think this will be interesting to see how it plays out, because you can end up with a pretty significant imbalance,
yeah,
in groups.
I also think it's interesting. I mean, they definitely would need to keep track of who ends up at the hospital anyway later on when the nurse practitioner arrives,
yep, and
the time, the window of time that it takes to actually get a nurse practitioner. I could see where if this is a common occurrence and the nurse practitioners start to get, you know, stressed and need to, you know, there's a need for more of them or more resources for them, that, you know, the end result, maybe it would have been cheaper, easier, better to just bring him into the emergency department and deal with it there. But kudos to them for looking at this. I think it, I would really love it if somebody in the Twin Cities or in the United States would take this on as a project as well, and could be able to follow the same methodology. I think that there are proponents for community paramedic who would say we don't need the nurse practitioner to do it. We can train a paramedic to do some of the interventions that this nurse practitioner would be doing. The jury's still out as to whether or not that nurse practitioner is going to have a lot more knowledge, assessment skills, ability to prescribe medications or get the right care to this particular individual with limited instrumentation and lab data, but I like them thinking this way.
My question is I know this is being done in Australia, and what's the difference between Australian paramedics and their training and education versus paramedics in the United States and their training and education?
But we're talking about a nurse practitioner in this protocol. Proposed protocol, right?
Well, the paramedic has to initially assess them.
Does the initial assessment and then calls for a nurse practitioner.
Right. So
which are
within 4 hours.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, good question.
So, you know, I mean, is, yep, you know,
are they receiving specialized training? Even along the lines of, we'll forget about the patient care part, just the research part of it. So how do you assess a true informed consent from a patient in this situation as a provider? We've been involved in trials where we've had providers do that in a stressful situation, and we know that it doesn't work well.
Well, I wonder, though, when I read this, I was thinking of that from the randomization process, that you randomize them at the time of discharge from the hospital. And so they are in a, they are either in a, are you thinking they're randomized by event?
Yep, so they get called to the house, right? From the way that I read this, they get called to the scene. The paramedic does the assessment of the patient. If they meet the inclusion criteria for potential for referral to the nurse practitioner, then they would get consent from the patient to be a part of this. They get a randomization from a predetermined...
And actually from the dispatcher.
Well,
then you've had
another bias into the system, and that is the mere presence of the paramedic performing an evaluation on them is different than their usual care. And so how do you measure that effect in and of itself?
Well, I think, wouldn't you agree, though, they're doing a normal evaluation on any patient that they would go through. They're just then selecting out those who fit potential for referral. So
I think from a system perspective, I'm not sure that that's what we envision as, you know, so, you know, I guess I would propose that other ways to look at it would be to, from our system, where, you know, we don't routinely use EMS to do screening exams, mm-hmm, and then make a decision. Just the mere fact of even considering a screening exam is in and of itself controversial, and people have debated the effects. Is that, you know,
we don't do screening exams, right. but then you get all sorts of people who dial 911 who don't want transport.
But we go there with the assumption you call, we haul.
You go there. You would like us to go there as a medical director with that assumption. And I don't know. I was just recently involved in one data abstraction project in which more than 50% of the calls were non-transports. And so...
Now, don't talk bad about your employer.
But no, no, it's not my employer. Gosh, no. Don't get me into trouble now.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying, Dave.
But it really does beg the question, when the public is told to dial 911, they were told to dial because there was an emergency, not because they needed transport to a hospital.
Right.
They want care. And the message we send is dial 911, dial 911, anything that you think is an emergency. And then
I think that that's where we have to discuss what the difference of a similar system study like this in the U.S. would be. And I think that most would, at least my envision of this, would be not just be outside the 911 system. We would pre-enroll potential candidates into a home health care evaluation where they would call a 7-digit number, of which then paramedics would be sent to the scene. And you would randomize the patients that would go into that program versus those that don't. And you track both, and you see the impact of those that receive pre-hospital evaluation or out-of-hospital evaluation by a paramedic and then are triaged off to non-hospital-based care compared to the randomly selected individuals with similar demographics, similar medical conditions, who don't have access to that option.
Well, I would argue that to me is fairly analogous to doing it the way that they've set this up, because if you give somebody who's, unless you're specifically talking to people as... Well, it would land in people who have already experienced some intervention in a hospital. They've gone home and are likely going to be instructed to call this 7-digit number specifically for this issue. So if you had a hip replacement, here's the 7-digit number to call if you're having a problem with your hip replacement. It would be fascinating to know how many of those people would call that 7-digit number for anything that happens to them. So I think this is a really unique approach in the ability of people who, for whatever reason, whether right or wrong, we don't think have the academic background to do a screening exam to see if they really can. And I think that it's going to be highly dependent on the service and the paramedic services, the paramedic buy-in into the project, because we've done similar work, Dave, with some of our agencies about non-transport. And you know, it's striking how often it's more of a nuisance to get somebody in the back of a truck than it is to just do it and transport them, and what that perception is, and then what the follow-up is. We had a significant enough number of non-transports in patients who then were subsequently seen 48 hours later. Correct. That caused us to change the way in which we even screen non-transport calls to make sure that they're being done appropriately. So,
well, I think that's the greatest. That's probably the greatest fear that's holding us back from moving forward with the community-based paramedic, is that now the paramedic is arriving in a non-transport vehicle, and could that in of itself be a negative incentive to result in transport? You've got a community-based paramedic who goes out and evaluates a little old lady who needs to go to the hospital and winds up calling his dispatch and his partners, and you're going, really, really, you know, when they get down to see, really, you thought this really needed to go to the hospital? Well, that becomes further a negative incentive, and that medic is going to be less, over time is going to be less likely. So you have to worry about that. What is the, you know, how do you control for that? So that your paramedic doesn't receive, you know, silent disincentives to perform their job appropriately.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see how often that, even to measure that perception, because from my perspective, I would trust an evaluation of my partner out in the field of somebody who needs to go, rather than relying on the patient themselves sometimes, or even the dispatcher, to say, yeah, you need to go. If I've got you, Dave, out in the field who's saying, this lady needs to go, there's enough going on here that I don't feel comfortable leaving her, I would be much more trusting of that than I would just a random 911 phone call. Yeah. So I guess I would argue the flip side of that coin, knowing that there's certainly, again, it's almost that individual level of who do you trust?
Yeah. And perhaps, you know, the disincentive is there already when we bring intoxicated patients right into the emergency department. All we have to do is look at the faces on the nursing staff and the physician staff when we dump those patients into the ER, and they say, why'd you bring us that? So there's just a, I think we live in a world where we can't please anybody. We're going to get dinged any which way direction we have. But it certainly begs the question about whether or not EMS's role outside of the all, you know, almighty, all scary life or death situation, how will we manage that within a healthcare system that seems to be in great flux, stressed incredibly, and probably more so in other cities than what we experience in the Midwest. And the overcrowding issues are just a lot bigger. The minor complaints are a lot larger, yeah, a lot more frequent. So,
and the other piece is the frequency of actual true legal action against people. We, you know, operate under this veil of heightened concern, but what are, you know, I don't know those answers, but what are the actual, what's the reality of people getting pulled into court for something like that? You know, you'd think that people would be able to identify some fairly straightforward large issues, and on the whole, is it more expensive to pay for a small lawsuit than it is to continue to do a bunch of non-transports or to continue to keep transporting people who shouldn't be using the healthcare system the way they are? It may be a wash in the end.
Very interesting concepts. Well, thank you again for tuning in to another edition of these PCRF podcasts.